All right, I want to pick up where we left off from last week. We left off in the 31st chapter of the book of Proverbs. Lord willing, we'll be able to finish up this book tonight. I don't know, for some reason we've had some problems with this Proverbs. I think we have done three chapters at least over again because of one difficulty after another. Now, this chapter 31 in Proverbs is a very, very unique chapter. And what makes it so unique to me is it's basically written by a woman. Now, it's written by this woman's son, Lemuel, but it's his mother's words to him. And that's what I find so fascinating about this, because they talk about an excellent wife here. And I've read this over and over again, and I've thought to myself many times that if this was written by a man, I think a lot of women would have an objection to what's being said here, because they feel like, well, this is just written by a male chauvinist pig trying to get women to act a certain way. But what's fascinating to me is written by a woman. And then when we get into it, I get this very distinct impression, because the very first verse in this chapter 31 says, the words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. And we've been through 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, and many years ago, 1 and 2 Chronicles. And there's no such king in Israel's history named Lemuel. So there's only two explanations. And one is that it's got to be a Gentile king. Or the other, it's a nickname for a king of Israel. And I really strongly believe it's a nickname for one of the kings of Israel. And this is speculative on my part, all right? But I believe that this King Lemuel is none other than Solomon himself. Because if you go back to Kings, you understand that there was the prophet Nathan, and he referred to, or he called Solomon, he called him Jedidiah. Anybody remember what Jedidiah means? It means beloved of the Lord. And Lemuel means belongs to the Lord. And I get this very distinct impression. It was his mother who gave him this nickname, Lemuel. Okay, belonging to the Lord. And like I said, it's speculative, but I really believe that these are the words of Bathsheba. And I'll explain it as we open this up, because it's fascinating to me. And I could be wrong on that, but she says in that verse 1, the words of King Lemuel, the oracle which his mother taught him. The oracle is something that's, it's not just prophetic, but it's also, it's heavy in its content. In other words, I always say, man, don't count your words, weigh your words. And I think that what is being said here is very, very weighty in terms of its insight. And it's, I think it's wisdom. And this is what she says. She says, what, O my son, and what, O my son of my womb, and what, O son of my vows, do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. It is not for kings, O Lemuel, it is not for kings to drink wine or for rulers to desire strong drink, for they will drink and forget what is decreed and to pervert the rights of the afflicted, of all the afflicted. Give strong drink to him who is perishing and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more. Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and the needy. Now, back up here, look at the way she phrases this, because I think this is very insightful too. If my speculation is correct, and these are the words of Bathsheba, I get this impression, because she's saying, what, O my son, and what, O son of my womb, and what, O son of my vow? So you're asking, why would she word it like that? And I get this very distinct impression. She's struggling. She's wrestling with, how do I say this to my son? How do I express this? Because what she's telling him is, she's basically saying, don't give your ways to other women. You know, she says, do not give your strength to women. Now, here's the thing. She understands firsthand what the consequences can be when you get involved in an adulterous affair, right? Because she saw what happened to David, who she got involved with. And because of his involvement with Bathsheba, look at all the things that came upon him as far as a judgment from God. I mean, he was running for his life from his son Absalom, and he had one problem after another. The sword never departed from his house because of what he had done, even though God forgave him. God still judged him, and he just reaped the whirlwind because of this adulterous affair. So it's almost like, I get the impression that his mother was involved in an adulterous affair, but it's like she just feels like, I'm struggling to how to tell my son not to do this, because she's lost her moral authority because she got involved with this. It's almost as though a person who has, let's say, just done something where they got themselves thrown in prison or thrown in jail, they feel like they can't really tell other people, hey, don't do that. So she's struggling with that. Now, that's what I say. It's speculative on my part, but I really get that impression. Because when you read that, you go like, well, why would she say that? What, O my son? And what, O son of my womb? And what, O son of my vows? Well, it's saying to me that she is really struggling how to tell this to her son, because she just feels like, I'm not in a position to tell him to do this because, you know, I haven't followed my own advice. But sometimes people who have really made horrendous mistakes can be the very ones to say, don't do that. And I'm telling you why, because I made this mistake and I just have paid such an enormous price, and I want you to avoid the same foolish things that I've done in my life. And she says, oh, what, oh my son, and what, oh son of my womb? Meaning that this isn't her stepson, this isn't an adopted son, this is her son, okay? And she says, and what, oh son of my vow? So it's kind of like, remember, go back to the book of Samuel, remember who made a vow about wanting a son? It was Hannah. Remember, she said to the Lord, she said, Lord, you know, if you would just give me a son. She was just desperate to have a child, and she was barren for many years, and she finally went to the temple at the tabernacle and just prayed her heart out and just was weeping convulsively before the Lord and asking for a son. And she made a vow to God. She said, if you will give me a son, I will give him back to you and dedicate him to you all the days of his life. Remember that? So this was a son of her vows, all right? And so I get this impression. What happened to the illegitimate son that Bathsheba had with David? What happened to him? Anybody remember? He died. God took him, and he told David that you've given my enemies an occasion to blaspheme. So this child that was born illegitimately or out of wedlock or through this adulterous affair, God took, because as far as God was concerned, David had put himself in a position where weaker believers could really stumble and God's enemies could really blaspheme. So the child was taken. So I get this impression that Bathsheba, if this is the same woman that wrote this or gave this counsel to Lemuel, she made a vow to God. Because it says right here, well, what son of my vow? So in other words, I get the impression she said, Lord, if you will grant me another son in place of the one that you took from me, I vow that I will really raise him up in the love and knowledge and fear of you, and I really do my utmost to invest myself into this child, you know, for your glory and honor. That's the impression I get. And then this is what she says to her son, Lemuel, which I believe is Solomon. She says, do not give your strength to women or your ways to that which destroys kings. She knows firsthand what will happen when you get involved in an adulterous affair, because it will just bring you down. It will destroy you. Look at how it just destroyed David. You know, it says a lot, because David was a man after God's own heart, but he just couldn't control himself, seeing a woman taking a bath, and he just... I think Satan just got right in there, and he got him at a weak moment when he wasn't really focused where he should have been. And then he says in verse 4, it says, it is not for kings, O Lemuel, it's not for kings to drink wine, for rulers to desire strong drink. For they will drink and forget what is decreed and pervert the rights of all the afflicted. And that says a lot, because, you know, she's talking about kings. In other words, put the word politician in there. And what is being said here? It's not being said like, well, it's wrong to drink alcoholic beverages, but what it's saying is that people who are in positions of authority and people who are in leadership, all right, if they have a habit of just being a drunk, I mean, what kind of leadership are you going to get out of these people? You understand what I'm saying? I mean, like, for example, in Ecclesiastes chapter 10, Solomon had said this, woe to you, O land, whose king is a lad and whose princes feast in the morning. He said, blessed are you, O land, whose king is of nobility and whose princes eat at the appropriate time for strength and not for drunkenness. And so you get a situation where you've got rulers that are always are just alcoholics or the drug addicts. I mean, what kind of leadership is that? They're just going to ruin a nation. They're going to destroy a nation. And they could also be drunk, not just on wine, but they could be drunk or intoxicated with their own power, with their own self-importance. And then when they do that, they'll just ruin a nation, because they don't have the nation's best interests at heart. They're just there, like so many of our politicians are today. They're just there to try to, you know, keep their position. They'll say anything, they'll do anything to get it reelected. And when they're in there, it seems like they're always trying to increase their salaries and their pensions and their perks and their per diems and everything you can think of. They just try to line their pockets. And you know what I'm saying? Well, these aren't leaders. These aren't rulers. These people are just blood-sucking parasitical drones who would just ruin a nation. And that's what she's talking about here. She says in verse 5, "For they will drink and forget what is decreed, and pervert the rights of all the afflicted." That's what happens when you have people of intemperance running a nation. In verse 6, he says, "Give strong drink to him who's imperishing, and wine to him whose life is bitter. Let him drink and forget his poverty, and let him remember his trouble no more." And that, what she's saying here is, if anybody's going to drink, let it be a person on her deathbed. People who are dying, especially if you're dying of a very, very difficult, like cancer, and it's very, very painful. Well, it's almost like it's an act of compassion to just pump them full of morphine or some kind of painkiller to deaden that pain, because they're dying and you can't save them. The only thing you can do is just try to lessen their pain in life. And I think that's what she's saying here. Give strong drink to him who's perishing or dying, right? And wine to him whose life is bitter. In other words, there's a time and a place for everything, and it's certainly not meant for people who are ruling and reigning or in position of leadership or power or authority. And he says in verse 7, "Let him drink and forget his poverty and remember his trouble no more." And in verse 8, he says, "Open your mouth for the mute, for the rights of all the unfortunate. Open your mouth, judge rightly, and defend the rights of the afflicted and the needy." That's just powerful to me. It really is, because we have a moral obligation before God to speak up for those who are defenseless. And, even though people just despise me, when I read this, it just jumps out at me. I just feel like, hey, you know what? We really do need to take a stand for the unborn. We have a moral obligation before God, because look what it says. It says here, "Open your mouth for the mute." Well, an unborn child can't speak for himself. He just can't, right? "And for the rights of the unfortunate." They're not in a position to plead their case. And God is going to hold us responsible if we don't stand up for their rights. They have an inalienable right before God. I mean, they're being created in the image and likeness of God. They belong to God. You know, remember when the people came to Jesus and they tried to, put him on two horns of a dilemma by saying, "Is it right to pay taxes to Caesar?" And he says, "You hypocrites, you phony, give me a coin." And he gave him a coin. He says, "Whose inscription and whose image is this?" He says, "It's Caesar's." "Well, then render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and unto God the things that are God's." Well, we're created in the image and likeness of God. So it belongs to God. This child belongs to God, not to us. And we've got to stick up for this child. But here's the thing. He says this, that verse 9, "Open your mouth, judge righteously, and defend the rights of the afflicted and the needy." Well, we've got a lot of people today who feel like, well, we're concerned for the poor. Well, let me tell you something. There's got to be consistency. All right? If we do not defend the rights of the unborn, then all this dribble about helping the poor is just hogwash. And it's hogwash before God. And it's the epitome of hypocrisy. In other words, remember what happened when Judas betrayed Christ, and then he felt remorse about doing so, and then he goes back to the scribes and the Pharisees and the Sadducees, and he said, "Man, I've betrayed innocent blood." And they say, "Oh, what's that to us, man?" And so Judas took those 30 pieces of silver that he sold Christ for, and he threw them into the temple sanctuary. And then he runs off and hangs himself. And then these good, quote-unquote, people, the scribes, the Pharisees, the Sadducees, the religious leaders say, well, they picked up the 30 pieces of silver and said, well, this is blood money. We can't really use it in the temple sanctuary. So they concocted this plan to do what with the money? To buy a potter's field to bury poor people in it. You see, to me, that was the height of hypocrisy. They were willing to railroad an innocent man to his death, and then to ease their consciences, what did they do? They turned around and did something for the poor. You see, to me, that it's got to be just rank before heaven. I mean, it's just an odious stench when you try to cover up your wickedness with this phony deed. And this is what people will do. They will say, well, we're concerned about the rights of the poor, but then they'll vote for the politicians that do what? They just undercut all the rights of the needy. So it's just a contradiction of terms. Anyway, I want to get into this last part, and this is the description of an excellent wife. Interesting thing. I don't know. I forget what you call this thing, where it's a type of a poem. And if I'm not mistaken, every single verse starts out with a consecutive letter of the Hebrew alphabet. In other words, if this was originally composed in English, every single verse would start out with A, and then B, C, D, all the way down to Z. And I think it's probably put there in that poetic form to help, I guess, memorize it and help recite it better or easier, that type of thing. But keep in mind when we're reading this, what I always do is when we're dealing with husbands and wives, you take it from the physical level, but you always take it to the spiritual level. All right, you apply both because they're very, very important, because we are told in Ephesians chapter 5, it says that this whole concept between Christ and his church is a mystery, and it's reflected between a husband and a wife in that one flesh union. And Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, he tells us this, that he says a person who joins himself to a harlot becomes one flesh with her, but he says a person who joins himself to the Lord becomes one spirit with him. And this whole concept of this sexual union between a husband and wife is a reflection between the one spirit union between God and his church. That's why God says over and over and over again that he's a jealous God and he won't have a rival. And so when you're reading this, just take this application as far as a spouse is concerned, a wife is concerned rather, that we are the bride of Christ. We are Christ's wife. And then make that application. Take it physically or take it literally, but then take it to the higher level, because I think it says volumes, speaks volumes. In verse 10 it says, an excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above jewels. The heart of her husband trusts in her, and he will have no lack of gain. She does him good and not evil all the days of her life. She looks for wool and flax and works with her hands in delight. She is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She rises also while it is still night, and she gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. She considers a field and buys it. From her earnings she plants a vineyard. She girds herself with strength and makes her arm strong. She senses that her gain is good, and her lamp does not go out at night. She stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hands grasp the spindle. She extends her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hands to the needy. She is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all of her household are clothed with scarlet. She makes coverings for herself. Her clothing is fine linen and purple. Her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen. Strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. She opens her mouth in wisdom, and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. She looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Her children rise up and bless her and her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Give her the product of her hands and let her works praise her in the gates. Now, just back up and just let's just analyze this and break this down, because I really do think it speaks volumes in terms of husband and a wife, and also our relationship with Christ as far as his bride. He says, an excellent wife who can find. Now, it doesn't say a perfect wife who can find. I think that says a lot. It really does, because I think people have a tendency to look for the perfect mate in life, and there's no such thing as a perfect mate. And God looks at us, and he's not looking for perfection, but what he is looking for is excellence. And what I mean by that is that we are always to be striving in our relationship with God. Like Paul says, he says, forget what lies behind, but always be pressing forward to the upward call of Christ Jesus. I mean, if our relationship with God is the same today as it was last year, there's something wrong with our relationship with God. All right? Because you can't be stagnant in our relationship with God, because here's the problem. We're either swimming upstream or we're drifting downstream. There is no standing still. We're either growing or shrinking. I mean, we're either making progress or we're digressing. That's the way it is in this spiritual warfare. We've got to continuously strive for excellence. And that's what he's looking for. He says, an excellent wife who can find, for her worth is far above jewels. I mean, you can't put a premium on this. You can't put a price tag on it as far as this type of wife. Well, in our relationship with God, it's the same thing. You know, this is what he looks for as far as what's valuable in a soul. I mean, he gazes right through our flesh, and he gazes right into our soul. And what does he see? Does he see a monster of iniquity, or does he see a soul that's just apathetic, lukewarm, indifferent as far as a relationship with God? Or does he see one that's really striving to try to please him and honor him and glorify him? And in verse 11 it says, the heart of her husband trusts her, and he will have no lack of gain. Now, apply that, obviously, to husband and wife. There's got to be a trust there, a bond there, because it says the heart of her husband trusts her. And because why? She has a track record that shows this woman is faithful to me. All right, but understand this too. It says here, he will have no lack of gain. In that verse 12, she does him good and not evil all the days of his life. So, in other words, when she says he will have no lack of gain, in other words, she's always doing something to do what?
to prosper him, to support him, to enrich him. And it says here, she does him good and not evil all the days of her life. This is the thing that we got to understand. There's a consistency there. I've had people ask me at times, and they feel like, I'm really not doing well in my spiritual walk. You know, I mean, what do you recommend? And I've told them this, and I may have mentioned it earlier in some of these early chapters going through Proverbs, is that the last thing I would recommend to anybody is, hey, okay, you really want to get right with God? Well, get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and start spending some quality time with God and really start disciplining yourself. No, I would never tell a person to do that. Would I tell a person, hey, you know what you need to do? You need to really start today and spend 10 minutes alone with God in prayer, quality time, prime time, and get away from that TV and the computer and the phone and everything else and just get alone with God and really, really connect with Him in prayer. Just 10 minutes, right? And then tomorrow, 10 minutes, and the next day, 10 minutes, for a whole 10 days, 10 minutes. And then see if you can stretch that into 15 minutes, 20 minutes, if possible, maybe even half an hour, maybe even sometimes, maybe even make it an hour. All I'm saying is the consistency is all important. It's no good if you spend 2 hours with God in prayer one day, and then the next 3 days, you don't spend any time in prayer. And then you go back to spending time in prayer. It's not going to work that way. There's got to be a constant, continuous consistency. If there's that consistency, then you will see there will be spiritual growth. Because what's physical attribute in the Bible portrays spiritual strength?
Hair.
All right. Now, here's the thing. Most of us can't see our hair. It's not very noticeable when our hair grows, all right, until after quite a while. But here's the thing. I think most men have this experience that if a man doesn't shave for one day, it may not be too noticeable. But within 10 days, it will be very noticeable if a man doesn't shave. You can see how fast your hair grows, right? That's why I'm saying the consistency is all important, because even though it may not seem like you're making much progress, believe me, inside of less than 2 weeks, there will be a noticeable difference in your relationship with God and your walk with God. And it will be, you may not even see it yourself, but it will be noticeable to other people. It will be the same as if a man didn't shave for 10 days. All right? It's going to be very noticeable because there's that consistency here. And that's the same thing we got to have with God, is consistency is all important. It can't be up and down, hit and miss, and all over the turf. It's got to be a consistency. And then in verse 13, it says, she looks for wool and flax and works with her hand in delight. In other words, a wife who is an excellent wife, she looks for opportunities to do what? I mean, she's productive, she's industrious, she's hardworking. In other words, if a man's married to a woman who's just a lazy, shiftless individual who spends her life watching soap operas day after day and sitting on a couch and munching on bonbons and doing nothing with it, and the whole house is a complete shambles and a complete mess, no man wants to come home to that. Is that an excellent wife? Now, take that to the spiritual level. She says she looks for wool and for flax and works with her hands with delight. In other words, if we are going to be a spouse that's really glorifying to God, we look for opportunities to glorify Him. But I think we have to understand something too. God has work for all of us to do, but we've got to be in tune with His work. And I'll give you an example. I read about a woman many years ago who had 5 kids, and she just up and left her husband one day and said, well, God's calling me to the mission field, you know. And, you know, she just was going to leave her family. I guarantee you, God was not calling her to the mission field. She just wanted to get out from under 5 kids and a husband and, you know, go on some exotic or romantic or, you know, exciting adventure in her life. My point is this. If she was really going to be an excellent wife, her main job would be to raise her children. And so if she really was going to glorify Christ, she would look for ways in which to raise up her children in the love and knowledge and fear of God. In other words, she'd look for opportunities to teach and instruct her children about God and their relationship with God. See what I'm saying? If you apply that, she looks for wool and for flax and works with her hands with delight. This is her driving ambition, to raise up her children and to become lovers of God, and or they fear God and they really cultivate a relationship with their Creator. And verse 14 says, she is like merchant ships. She brings her food from afar. She rises. Okay, now even that, apply it to, let's just say, marriage. Take it at physical level. Well, an excellent wife very often is a woman who is a very, very good cook, right? I mean, I'll just throw this out there. I would rather have a wife who's a lousy cook and come home to a wife with a sweet disposition. because I, you know, I could throw on my own food, you know, but I can't handle a woman who's got, you know, not a sour disposition. All right. So when you read something like this, certain things may be more important to one man and not as important to another man, but still, it's that, you know, an excellent wife is going to try to really do what? Meet her husband's needs or his desires or his wants. Now take that to the spiritual level. That's where this is all going, to the spiritual level. When it says here, she is like a merchant ship, she brings her food from afar. Well, if she's raising up her children, what's their food? In other words, she looks for different opportunities to teach her children about God and looks for different, I don't know, books or materials or whatever to try to do what? To try to instruct her children in love and knowledge and fear of God. See, verse 15 says, she rises also while it's still night and gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. So if it says she rises early in the morning while it's still night, what does that suggest to you about her character, about her? What does it say, suggest to you?
She's selfless.
Well, not only that, but she's pretty darn industrious. She's not lazy. She's not shiftless. I mean, we've read twice now in Proverbs where Solomon says, a little more sleep, a little more slumber, a little more folding of their hands of rest, of your hands to rest, and your poverty will break in on you like an armed man. I mean, I know this one particular girl, she would sleep till, you know, 1, 2, 3 in the afternoon all the time. At her parents' house. And, you know, that just became almost like, at first, it may not seem like it's a big deal, but after doing this day after day and week after week and month after month and year after year, these habits really begin to become so, strong. They become almost like iron cables that you just, that now this is your habit. This is you. You have really sown a destiny here. This is you. This is your character. You know, and you just become a lazy, shiftless slob, in a sense, that in the end, man may allow you to get away with that, but God's going to judge you for that. But this woman here is just, she's industrious, all right? She rises while it's still night, and she gives food to her household and portions to her maidens. In other words, she not only provides for her children and her husband and her household, but she provides for others as well. When she says, and proportions for her maidens and those to her servants, those who work under her. And verse 16 says, she considers a field and buys it, and from her earnings she plants a vineyard. Now, in other words, this woman is pretty wise as far as money goes. I mean, she handles money very intelligently, and she makes wise investments. That's what the suggestion is here. But now, take that to the spiritual level. It says she considers a field and buys it. As a matter of fact, let me just read what Christ said up in Matthew. He said it in Matthew 13. He said this. He says, the kingdom of heaven is like a treasure hidden in a field, which a man found and hid again, and from joy over it, he goes and sells all that he has and buys the field. And right after that, Jesus said, and again, the kingdom of heaven is like a merchant seeking fine pearls. And upon finding one pearl of great value, he went and sold all that he had and bought it. And you read this here, where it says that she considers a field and buys it, and from her earnings she plants a vineyard. Apply that spiritually now. There was a book out there many years ago by this Juan Carlos Ortiz, if I'm not mistaken, and it was called The Pearl of Great Price. And in this book, he just gives this fictitious account about this guy who's walking along one day window shopping, and he came across this one particular shop, and he looked in the window and he saw this huge, humongous pearl. And he was just absolutely flabbergasted by what this pearl looked like, the size of it, and just the flawlessness of this pearl. He just went into the shop there and he asked the proprietor, he says, hey, how much is that pearl? And the proprietor said, well, you know, that costs a great deal. He said, oh, I can imagine that costs a lot. He says, who could buy such a pearl? And the proprietor says, well, anybody can buy it. He said, what do you mean anybody can buy it? I thought he said it costs a great deal. He says, well, it does. And he says, well, what do you mean anybody can buy it? He says, well, it costs all you have. And so the guy started thinking about it. He says, well, you know what? I want to get that pearl. I want to buy that pearl. He says, okay. So he sits down with the proprietor, and the proprietor brings out a pencil and paper. He says, well, okay, well, what do you have? He said, well, I got $10,000. This is my life savings. I can go down right now and get a cashier's check and come back and give it to you right now if you let me buy that pearl. He writes down, okay, $10,000. He says, well, what else do you have? He says, well, that's it. That's my life savings. He says, well, where do you live? He says, well, I live in a house. So he writes that down, one house. Oh, he says, oh, well, you mean I got to sleep in my camper? He says, oh, you got a camper? He says, well, yeah. So he writes the camper down. He says, wow, I got to sleep in my car? He says, oh, you had a car? He says, yeah, I got two cars. So he writes that down, two cars. And he says, wow. He says, boy, this is really costing a lot. He says, well, what else does it cost? And he says, are you married? He says, yeah, I got a wife and two kids. So he writes that down, wife and two kids. And then he says, man, you're not kidding. This costs a lot. And he says, I have to think this over. He says, you know, you've got everything. My $10,000, my house, my wife, my kids, my car, my campers. And he says, you got everything but the shirt on my back. And he writes that down, one shirt on your back. And so the guy thought about it, man, I don't know if I should do that. I don't know. But then he wanted that pearl so bad, he just came back and he said, look, okay, you can have it all. Give me that pearl. And the guy says, okay, here, you can have the pearl. He says, but here's the thing. He says, everything that you've now given me in payment for this pearl, he says, you can still use. You can still use it like it's yours. But understand something. It really belongs to me now. And if I decide that I want anything or all the everything here, you can't protest to that. So the guy walked out of there with this pearl at a great price, and he also walked out of there with everything he had when he walked in there. And that's our relationship with God is like that. I mean, it's like we're willing to sell it all for Christ's sakes. I mean, we get it all back. We get it all thrown in. And, you know, I'm just making an application here because it says she considers a field and buys it. You know, she sees the value of spiritual things. You can't put a premium on these things. If we put God first in our life, I mean, I guarantee you, guarantee you, on your deathbed, you will not regret it. You will not regret it. Nobody on our deathbed says, oh man, I wasted my life. I've given my all to Jesus Christ all my life, and I could have had that speedboat. I could have done this, that, and the other. You know, people don't talk like that. But I tell you what, a lot of people on our deathbed have a lot of regrets, you know, because they feel like, you know, I really have wasted my life. I could have been serving Christ and giving my all for God and even for my family and my kids. Instead, I wasted it in this job and this career and this stupid thing. I wasted it all on drugs or booze or whatever. You know, nobody ever says I wasted it on Jesus Christ. I guarantee it because they see the value of him. And it also says here in verse 17, says she girds herself with strength and makes her arm strong. That's interesting too. In other words, this is a woman, this is a spouse, this is a wife who keeps herself physically fit. And I think most men would agree that that's important to a man because that's the way men are. Men are visual, and it's important to have, for a man to have a good looking spouse. People may say, well, he's just a male chauvinist pig. Well, put it this way, that's why God made men. And I've said it many times. I mean, most women would rather be beautiful than smart because they know that most men can see a lot better than they can think. So this woman does what? She girds herself with strength and makes her arms strong. Now, here, take this to the spiritual level. Okay, take it to the spiritual level. She girds herself with strength. Now, how do we do that with Christ in our spiritual walk? Okay, it takes spiritual discipline. It really does. We have to apply ourselves. I mean, if you just sit on a couch and do nothing but eat potato chips and drink beer year after year, and then they say, well, I'm going to get in shape. Tomorrow I'm going to get up and run a marathon. That's absurd. That's ridiculous. You're not going to get 10 yards before you're wheezing and gagging and dry heaving. Why? You have to discipline yourself. You really have to make it consistent, all right, in order to do what? In order to gird yourself with strength. But also in Ephesians chapter 6, it talks about putting on the full armor of God. It says, gird your loins with truth. What does that mean?
Person of integrity.
Yeah.
Through your word.
Yeah. When you gird your loins, this is the strongest part of your body. We've got to be walking in truth. We can't be hypocrites or we can't be dishonest people and think that we're going to become strong spiritually. It's just not going to happen. He says, she girds herself with strength and makes her arm strong. Verse 18 says, she senses that her gain is good and her lamp does not go out at night. That, to me, says a lot, too. She senses that her gain is good. A woman who really invests herself into her marriage, into her relationship with her husband and her family, I mean, she's going to sense a sense of purpose there, right? I don't care what the women's libbers say that she is. But now apply that spiritually because it says she senses that her gain is good and her lamp does not go out at night. Well, it was Jesus who said this. He said when his apostles went into town to get some food and then they came back with the food and Jesus says, I have meat to eat. And they went, well, who gave him something to eat? And he says that his meat or his food was to do the will of him who sent him. In other words, to do the will of his Father. As human beings, we really do need meaning and not just meat if our lives are going to be abundant, you know, fulfilled. If we have no meaning, then what are we doing? We're just existing. And there is no real lasting meaning apart from God in our relationship with Him. And when you read this, he senses that our gain is good. I really strongly believe that if we invest our time and our money and our energy into knowing and loving and serving God, there's a sense of purpose there. And there's a sense that your life is not wasted, right? She senses that her gain is good and her lamp does not go out at night. Well, that's interesting too. Because what did Jesus say about lamps? He says, nobody takes a lighted lamp and puts it under a peck measure. I said, and nobody takes a lighted lamp and puts it under a bed. Suggesting this, that a person's light can go out or be greatly diminished if we put that lamp under a bed. The bed, it symbolizes what? Sensuality, slothfulness, ease, this type of thing. The peck measure was a basket of commerce. If you put a basket over a lighted lamp, it's going to be greatly reduced or extinguished or put out. And like Jesus is saying this, money, material things, this type of thing can greatly extinguish our lamp. And Jesus said this, put the lamp in such a way, or let your light shine in such a way, that men will see your good works and do what?
Glorify
your Father who is in heaven. In other words, if we do good works, it's not to draw attention to ourselves. The good works are to do what? To glorify God. That men will glorify God when they see your good works. But Jesus said, let your light shine before men. Well, if you put this, take this to the spiritual realm, her lamp does not go out at night. In other words, it's there all the time. It's not something that you turn on and off. In other words, look what happens like a lot of people, let's just say, they go to church on Sunday. That's the extent of their relationship with God. And then they live like hell the rest of the week. I mean, well, their lamp's going out. That's what I say. It's got to be that consistency. Yeah.
And also, another application might be when you have a purpose to follow after, your countenance is lifted. And if you don't have a purpose and difficulties come on, you know, the night time comes on, that can extinguish your light. You're just depressed.
Yeah.
There's no hope, you know, when troubles come. But if you have purpose, it's like that purpose can keep you going through, keep that light
right
going at night.
Right.
Difficult times.
Good. That's a good point. I read something, don't quote me about this, but I did read about like during the Depression, for example, and I wasn't around then, but I've done a lot of reading about that, and that that even though people were really hurting financially and really, you know, scraping, the suicide rate was way down. But now, look at what happened when we've got so many materialistic things and so much affluence and money and things like this. The suicide rate went way up. Now, how do you account for that? The purpose was missing. And this is what you see so often when you don't have a purpose. A purpose can drive you in spite of your circumstances. But if you don't have a purpose and your circumstances seem overwhelming, well, then you try to escape one way, shape, or form or another. If it's not suicide, then it's drugs or something else. And there's no purpose apart from Christ. You see, that's a sad thing. It really is. I know 6 people personally who have taken their lives. And it's a sad thing. It's a very, 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 very sad thing. And verse 19, she says, she stretches out her hands to the distaff, and her hands grasp the spindle. That a distaff, I guess it was just a little stick that had a lot of yarn or thread on it, and that she would be using that to do what? To sew, or sometimes there was a distaff on a spinning wheel where they would use for sewing purposes. So she says she stretches out her hand to the distaff. In other words, she knows how to sew really well. She's making clothes for her household. In other words, she's a worker, right? But like I said, I mean, a lot of women who might read this, well, I can't sew. Well, that doesn't mean you're not an excellent wife, okay? Because certain things are more important to men than others, you know what I'm saying? Especially in our day and age. In other words, you can just go down to the Gap and pick up a pair of pants or whatever, you know.
Work in the workforce today,
right,
too.
Right, that's and that's going
to
be brought out, too.
I'd love to say all the darn socks.
Yeah, well, Yeah. He's talking about, she stretches out her hands to the distaff and her hands grasp the spindle. In other words, she really is industrious and she really does accomplish a great deal. And just take that to the spiritual level. And verse 20 says, she extends her hand to the poor and she stretches out her hands to the needy. This shows a lot about her character, right? And then again, too, what did Christ say? He says, what you do to the least of my brethren, you do unto me. And at the end of the world, when he judges the sheep and the goats, is going to be on the basis of what you did for me. I was hungry, I was thirsty, I was sick, I was naked, I was in prison, I was a stranger. What you do? It says here, she extended her hand to the poor, and she stretches out her hand to the needy. And, you know, we've even read in Proverbs how it says that he who lends to the poor lends to his maker. And that the one who scoffs at the poor really brings judgment upon himself. So she's concerned about the needs of other people. And it says a lot about her character, and it says a lot about her spiritually. And he says here in verse 21, she is not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. That's interesting too. She provides for her household, and that verse 20 suggests that she makes a lot of the clothes for her household. But what's interesting, if you take this to the spiritual level, look at that verse 21. She's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. What scarlet point to?
Blood of Christ.
Yeah. Because remember, Rahab was told, look, if you want to be saved, you've got to put a scarlet thread out your window. And that everybody that's in your household will be saved if they're under that scarlet thread. That pointed to the blood of Christ. And so when it says here, she's not afraid of the snow for her household, for all her household are clothed with scarlet. In other words, apply that spiritually. She makes sure that all of her household is under the blood of Christ. In other words, that they are redeemed and they have a living relationship with their Creator. Because here's the thing. God doesn't have any grandchildren, and each individual soul needs to come to Christ. And I think it's primarily the parents' responsibility to raise up their children in that way. I've had parents tell me, look, well, I'm not going to bring my kids to church and tell them all about God. I'm going to wait till they reach an age where they can make the choice for themselves. To me, that's totally asinine. It's absolutely asinine, because what kind of choice do you think you're going to make? They're just going to follow your stupid lead. That's all there is to it. I mean, from day one, I taught my children about God. Every opportunity I had, I tried to tell them about God. And to the point where it just became second nature. I always remember Caleb as a little kid. Could already talk, but he came running up to me one day and he had a little potato bug in his hand. He says, I found a roly-poly, I found a roly-poly. You know, and he's all excited. I says, well, who made the roly-poly? He says, well, God made the roly-poly. And I says, well, why did God make the roly-poly? And he says, well, he made it for me. And I thought, you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. You see, it's the most natural thing in the world for a kid to believe in God. You got to beat it out of them. And that's what people are doing today. Our schools and all these modern-day Philistines, they're just beating the knowledge of God out of little kids. All right? And then where are these kids going to end up? They're going to end up in jail. They're going to end up in prison. They're going to end up in rehab. They're going to end up on Skid Row. They're going to end up taking their life. They're going to end up on any number of things. To me, it's absolutely asinine and foolish and stupid to say, well, I'm going to let my kid make his own decision. No, you cultivate that in a kid about the love and knowledge and fear of God, because the Bible says it. Proverbs, it says that raise up a child in the way he should go, and when he is old, he shall not depart from it. It's our responsibility. The ball's in our court, and believe me, parents are going to have to account to God. And I said this earlier, and as terrible as it sounds, I know it's true. I know in my heart of hearts it's true. There's a lot of people in hell today cursing their parents because their parents never raised them up the way they should have been. And he says here in verse 22, she makes covering for herself, for her clothing is fine linen and purple. And just make that application too. Fine linen and purple, it points to the righteousness of Christ. But also, you know, take it to the physical level. It just simply means that she really looks out diligently for the welfare of her household. In verse 23, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. What does that mean? What do the gates point to?
Seat of power, decision.
Well, yeah, the gates, traditionally, during Solomon's day, during Christ's day, and during David's day, in biblical history, early biblical history, that's where people would gather at the gates, where you would have the judges. All right, it's like courts today, because there they held court, and there the judges would, people would come to them with their disputes or with their complaints or whatever else they had, and then the judges would decide. Well, it says here, her husband is known in the gates when he sits among the elders of the land. In other words, with the suggestion there is that she supports her husband, all right, and he's in a position of prominence. And the suggestion that he's in a position of prominence suggests to me that this guy's not a deadbeat. you know, this is the thing that people have to understand when it comes to marriage. It's like, don't look for the perfect partner. They're not there, all right? They don't exist. Perfection doesn't exist this side of eternity, all right? But excellence can be something to strive for, all right? All I'm saying is this. If you can look through some of these imperfections and see if this person is an excellent person, I mean, I've seen people just leave their spouses because of one stupid, foolish thing, and then realize, you know, I made a horrendous mistake. So when you read something like this, her husband is known in the gates when she sits among the elders of the land, it shows a situation that, you know, she's not married to a deadbeat. Neither one of them are perfect, but you're striving for excellence there. But then now take that to the spiritual level. Her husband is known at the gates. Well, we're talking about Christ here. He's the Judge of Judges, the Lord of Lords, the God of God, the King of Kings, right? And that's who we serve. And in verse 24, she makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen. What is she doing? She's making extra money, bringing extra money for what? For her household. She makes linen garments and sells them and supplies belts to the tradesmen, all right? She may not be the primary breadwinner here, but she's very, very supportive as far as finances of the household is concerned. And statistics bear out that one of the primary causes of divorce today is because of money and monetary issues. And it really does cause an awful lot of friction in a marriage. But here you see a woman who's very, very supportive of her husband as far as the meeting the household needs. Well, apply that spiritually, too. What are we doing to enrich the kingdom of God or build up the church of Christ or the house of God? And verse 25 says, strength and dignity are her clothing, and she smiles at the future. Well, all right, strength and dignity are her clothing. This is a woman who carries herself well, all right? Strength and dignity. I mean, this woman has class. We read earlier about where Solomon says, a woman lacking discretion is like a fine gold ring in a pig's snout. In other words, it's completely out of place. I mean, have you ever seen a very, very attractive woman, and then what comes out of her mouth is just cursing and swearing, and it's just this foul language, and wow, that just does not fit. That just does not go together. Well, here's a situation where you say strength and dignity are clothing, and she smiles at the future. This woman has a lot of class, right? She carries herself with dignity, but also she smiles at the future. Anybody who's really sold out to Christ, regardless of how difficult our circumstances are right now, what we're struggling with right now, you know, and I'll tell you, I had one horrendous day. I mean, that seemed like the devil was throwing everything out at me, including the kitchen sink. But, you know, in spite of all my frustration, I look at the future because I see my future in Christ. So you can smile at the future and you realize that whatever you're going through right now, I mean, this is going to be long forgotten. In no time, right?
One day we're going to party.
Yeah. All right. Well, we've got to wind this down. It says, verse 26, she opens her mouth in wisdom and the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. It opens her mouth in wisdom. Well, she's not going to have wisdom unless there's a fear of God, right? Because fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And the teaching of kindness is on her tongue. So you can see that. Kindness is one of the fruits of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, patience, kindness, goodness, gentleness, self-control, right? Well, she can see this woman is spirit-filled. And in verse 27 says, she looks well to the ways of her household and does not eat the bread of idleness. Looks well to the ways of her household. I mean, this isn't a lazy, syphilis, good-for-nothing slob, right? It says, how many times did God talk about in the book of Proverbs alone about idleness, about slothfulness, about indolence? And God has a lot to say about that, right? Some people feel like, well, you just don't want to overdo it. You don't want to work yourself to death. You don't want to burn yourself out. Well, I never see that in the scriptures. I'm not advocating that. I'm just simply saying I don't think God's concerned about that. What he's concerned about is that we become lazy and shiftless and indolent, and that's what he's concerned about. Well, and then in verse 28 it says, her children rise up and bless her and her husband also, and he praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. Well, her children rise up and bless her. Apply that spiritually too. Who were our children? I mean, Paul referred to Timothy as his son or as his child, but he wasn't his blood child, but he was a spiritual child. Well, you know, if we produce fruit for Christ in terms of leading other people to a saving knowledge of him, well, a lot of times, the people we lead to Christ will, in turn, be very grateful and honor and bless us for that. But he also says her husband also praises her, saying, many daughters have done nobly, but you excel them all. And what does Christ say? One of the parables about the coins. He says, well done, thou good and faithful servant. You've been faithful in little, you know, now I'm going to put you in charge of much. Well, to me, there's no greater compliment to try to aspire for is the compliment from God. You know what I'm saying? Too many people today have a fear of men, or they want the compliments of men. And I'm saying, man, that's not the way to go. All right? What you really want is to have God commend you. God compliment you. God say, well done, thou good and faithful servant. And then he says in verse 30, he says, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain, but a woman who fears the Lord, she shall be praised. Charm is deceitful. Let's face it. I mean, it's just a fact of life. A woman could be very, very charming, and it could really be a hook for a man. But then if he doesn't see past her character, that charm can evaporate in a heartbeat. And then next thing you know, he's wondering, well, who are you? Where'd you come from? Because the charm's gone. But he's saying, charm is deceitful and beauty is vain. But what? But a woman who fears the Lord shall be praised. And that's what we're looking for here. What did Peter talk about? Don't let your beauty be external only, as far as just putting on dresses and makeup and the jewelry and this type of thing. He says, let it be the hidden person of the heart, which is quality that is cherished before God and men. And then verse 31, give her the product of her hands and let her work praise her in the gates. Give her the product of her hands. In other words, she ends up being rewarded for all of her hard work. And it says here, and let her work praise her in the gates. Well, the gates, like I said, that's the place of judgment. And that's what God's going to do to each and every one of us when we stand before him as this quote-unquote spouse, right? Is there's going to be that judgment. And even Paul says it, even as Christians, he says it in Romans and he says it in Corinthians, he says we will all stand before the judgment seat of Christ. And I can't think of a more heavy thing to think about, to contemplate, is standing before God. Because you're not going to have some lying, cheating, stealing, flamboyant lawyer next to you trying to get you off on a technicality. You're going to stand there alone before God. And he's going to judge you. Now, understand something. If you are saved, if you've given your life to Christ, he's not going to be a judge and act as your judge in terms of whether you're going to heaven or hell. But he is going to review our works. And we are told in Corinthians chapter 3, verse 10, it says that all of our works are going to pass through the fire. And he says that everything's going to be tested. And so he says, you better be building with gold and silver and precious stones, because if you're building with wood, hay, and stubble, it's all going to go up in smoke. So what really constitutes gold, silver, and precious stones is what we do out of love for God. That's what really constitutes gold, silver. It doesn't matter how small the deed is. Jesus himself said, if you so much as give a cold glass of water in my name to the least of my brethren, it will not lose its reward. You see, so what are you doing? You're doing it out of love for God. That's what makes it gold. That's what makes it precious in the sight of God. And that's what's not going to go without a reward. It may be something we long forgotten about, but God has not forgotten about it, and heaven has not forgotten about it. But it's got to be a love for God. But Jesus himself said, don't do things to be seen by men or to be praised by men, because if you do, you've already have your reward. But if we do things out of love for God, then that will not lack a reward. It's going to pass through the fire. Like, for example, I've been teaching this Bible study for, I don't know, 36 years or whatever. All right. Now, I can't say what's going to happen to me in the judgment. Everything I do may go up in smoke. I mean, I pray that it won't. But here's the thing. Am I elevating Christ here, or am I trying to bring attention to myself? If I elevate Christ, then it will receive a reward. It's got to be done out of love for him. Everything that we do, big or small, whatever it is, that's what it boils down to. That your works will praise you in a gate. They will praise you in judgment. Anybody have anyone to add or share?